Dr. Jonathan Howard says over 800,000 Americans would be alive today if the United States had taken New Zealand's COVID approach. After witnessing mass death and suffering on the front line during New York's first wave of the pandemic, he was furious to hear influential health professionals minimise the seriousness of the virus. "We want them infected," said presidential science advisor Paul Alexander. And that's the title of Dr. Howard's new book, which tells the story of how some medical and public health professionals came to become anti-vaccine and pro-herd immunity. Dr. Howard is a neurologist and psychiatrist based in New York City, from where he joins us now. Good morning, good evening.
Good morning to you. Thanks so much for having me on. I sure appreciate it.
It's a pleasure. First thing to say, you're not an epidemiologist or a virologist, right?
I'm not an epidemiologist. I'm not a virologist. I have, I think, two qualifications that led me to write this book, one of which you already mentioned, the fact that I worked in a hospital throughout COVID. I worked through New York City's COVID deluge 3 years ago at this time. Our hospitals were overflowing with COVID patients. And the second of these is I've been studying the anti-vaccine movement for the past decade or so. So it was a real surprise to see how widespread it became during the pandemic.
Herd immunity does not automatically go hand in hand with anti-vax, though, does it?
Well, herd immunity is basically a potential fact of nature that if enough people are infected with a virus or vaccinated for it, and that virus gives robust immunity, there will be herd immunity, assuming no new children are born. Of course, babies are not born with natural immunity, and they provide a reservoir for the virus to continue to spread, which is why humanity has never before eliminated a virus by spreading that virus.
But you can be pro-vaccination in order to reach some kind of herd immunity. That's how it works, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. You're right. I mean, we have in the United States, at least temporarily, and probably much of the world, herd immunity for measles, for example. And so what this means is that it doesn't mean that measles is totally gone, but we have periodic outbreaks here where there's maybe 300 or 400 children infected that are people. That would be a rather large outbreak, but it doesn't spread wildly and out of control. And that's entirely due thanks to vaccines. So herd immunity is by no means a bad word or a problematic goal to strive for.
So what was the problem with the concept of herd immunity when it came to COVID?
So I wouldn't say there's a problem with the concept of herd immunity when it came to COVID, except for the fact potentially that we now know that this virus does not create robust immunity, that you can get infected multiple times with the virus. So that's problem number one. And the bigger problem, as the name of the book implies, we want them infected, is that doctors wanted to try to reach herd immunity not through a vaccine, but by purposefully exposing unvaccinated children, young adults, even younger middle-aged adults to the virus in the hopes that that would create enough herd immunity to make the virus essentially disappear and allow people who are considered not vulnerable to leave their hiding in just a matter of months.
And indeed, sorry to interrupt, but I mean, you bought into that you supported that approach. You're quite frank about this in your book. You say, "I made an ass of myself several times during the pandemic. In August 2020, you said, given that COVID is benign in the vast majority of young children, I doubt that it will become a major killer for decades in the future like measles. Young kids will likely develop natural immunity and hopefully a vaccine will create immunity in adults." Number of things wrong with that statement, as you now admit, right?
Oh, yeah, no, I'm very clear in the book that I was not perfect and that I made mistakes. I try to be very upfront about the things that I got wrong. And I think at least a little bit in my defense, that was sort of a one-off tweet that I sent. I was not someone who went on the national news and influenced our politicians to try to spread the virus. And I think the first two words of that tweet really sort of expressed what I was saying at the time, that it was a hopeful sort of thing. And it was I was hoping at the time that once children got infected with this virus, that it would create permanent lifelong immunity. But yeah, boy, I was wrong that it doesn't create lifelong immunity. And the vaccine is the best way to go. There's no question about it. And also at that time when I sent that, we had no idea that if a vaccine was going to be years away or months away. We were all sort of hopeful. But yeah, I'm unsparing of my criticism of other doctors and unsparing of criticism of myself as well.
Quite right. But the main point you're making is that the children who got COVID were not suffering necessarily from a very mild disease. It could have very serious effects, and this was not accepted early enough.
Yeah, I think when we talk about COVID in children, we're talking about two different things. So the risk to an individual child of COVID is very low. So all the children in my life had COVID. My own children, my nieces and nephews, some before they were vaccinated, and they did fine, like the vast majority of children. But the problem is when you add up rare events and multiply it by 73 million children in America, rare events began to add up to significant numbers. So I think that the risk for any individual child with COVID is very low. But COVID's overall impact on children has not been benign, and we're going to be learning about the consequences of repeat infections the rest of our lives. So I think we have to be really humble about that.
Yes, but the other problem is not only does catching COVID not confer immunity, the vaccination does not confer immunity, neither does it prevent transmission. This is the problem that really undermined any effort to contain COVID, isn't it?
So the vaccine does not prevent transmission. It does limit it. It depends on the variant. It's not useless in stopping transmission. And it certainly is not useless at preventing infection either, although, of course, we all know plenty of vaccinated people who have been infected. Multiple members of my family have. But it's very good, especially in children, at preventing these very rare but grave outcomes. So it's kind of like wearing a seatbelt. When you get in a car, it's not going to guarantee that you're going to live if you get into a car crash, but it's much better than driving without a seatbelt.
So you're saying that if the United States had adopted New Zealand's zero tolerance, then 800,000 Americans would still be alive.
That's what the numbers say. I mean, obviously, there are more differences between our two countries than just the policies that were adopted. I mean, you certainly have the advantage of being an island with the people not coming in and out, although certainly other island countries, namely the UK, failed to handle COVID as well as you did. But if we had limited infections until we had vaccinated the vast majority of our population, we potentially would have had hundreds of thousands of people still be alive today. There's no question about that.
Is that practical in a country like the United States? As you say, New Zealand has the advantage of being an island nation, much easier to close the borders and to tell people to stay at home. Could that possibly have been done in the United States?
I think in a different universe, potentially. I mean, unfortunately, our population was just deluged with false information from the very start of the pandemic, from very influential voices, people telling, and that's what the book is about, that famous doctors from our top universities went on television and told people that COVID was just going away, that it was just the flu, that young people under the age of 65, for example, have essentially no risk, that it's more dangerous than driving back and forth to work. And not only were there not attempts to limit the virus, these were loud, influential voices who wanted to spread it. So they advocated for policies, not just that didn't limit the spread, but that purposefully spread the virus. And you can read quotes from our former COVID advisor, Donald Trump's former COVID advisor, celebrating rising cases, saying this is a good thing when cases rise, which is shocking and astonishing.
One of the people that you have in your sights in this book is Dr. J. Bhattacharya. He wrote an article in August 2022 called Zero COVID Has Cost New Zealand Dearly. And he was one that wanted unvaccinated young people to contract COVID. Is he wrong?
Well, you can answer that question better than me. You live there and you live through it. You know what your what your you know what happened to your country. I mean, I think the fact that most of your grandparents are still alive means that zero COVID did not cost you dearly. His point was that New Zealand's economy suffered due to lockdowns, that you guys didn't have any tourists, for example. But of course, even if things were completely wide open at the time, it's not as if your tourist industry, people would have traveled to New Zealand probably, and it's not as if things could have continued as normal. So I look at the numbers, I look at your death rate with great jealousy, and I think for long periods of time, your economy was even more open than ours was because we had to keep locking down. Our COVID kept closing schools just because there were overwhelming outbreaks of the virus.
Everybody acknowledges, as you write in your book, that the virus is dangerous for the elderly and the infirm. But there is a notion that for everybody else, it was, as you say, the fear of the virus and the measures to contain it that posed a greater threat. And Dr. Bhattacharya says, you know, the economic cost, the cost of deferred healthcare for people, the cost of that zero COVID approach is often intangible, but very, very real. How do you discount that?
So I don't discount that. There were real costs of the lockdowns. I don't know anyone who sort of argues otherwise, and I want to be very clear that I was protected from those costs, meaning I am very fortunate to be employed. I worked throughout the pandemic. I was never lonely. I don't have my own business. So I don't mean to discount the harms of the lockdowns. I just don't think that the alternative of sort of letting the virus spread very widely would have yielded a better outcome. Here in New York City, for example, when forklifts were needed to move bodies into giant refrigerated trucks, it's a fantasy that restaurants and theaters and offices could have operated as normal. It was certainly, you talk about deferred healthcare, every single healthcare worker was working with COVID patients. Our hospitals were overflowing. So when I hear people lament, say, miss cancer screenings, who would have done those screenings? Would elderly patients have left their house to go to quiet, you know, to go to crowded waiting rooms to get a mammogram, for example? I don't think so. You know, I'm a neurologist, I'm a psychiatrist, and here I am treating a primarily respiratory virus. These were not normal times. You had pediatricians treating adults. You had obstetricians and gynecologists treating men. So things were, it was all hands on deck moment. And I think that the fantasy is that things could have just been normal if only if it wasn't for overly cautious politicians.
Opposition to the vaccine mandates and the lockdowns in New Zealand was quite substantial. And this morning I'm hearing from people saying, you know, this is entirely wrong. There are major repercussions for our country thanks to the lockdown. And who are you sponsored by? The suspicion of you is quite evident in the texts I'm receiving. You better disclose any relationship you have with any of the vaccine companies.
Yeah, so I have no religion. You can go, the United States government mandates, there's something called the Sunshine Act. So you can go to, there's a website called opencmspayments.com, and you can type in any doctor's name and you can see what money we have received from pharmaceutical agents, pharmaceutical companies. I think in the past decade, I've received about $300 from pharmaceutical companies in the forms of various lunches. They have paid for some research that I have done. That money does not go to me. That money goes to my institution. But it's a fear, right? Some of these people are conflicted. And I think that a lot of the doctors that I write about have gotten a large amount of money through right-wing donors or by writing for Substack, which is a monetizable platform. So I don't think it's a bad question. But let me just say that the care of a COVID patient who is sick and in the hospital is extremely, extremely expensive. And so the idea that vaccines do not save not just lives, but save money as well. And a lot of that money goes to pharmaceutical companies when you're in the hospital with COVID. It just doesn't make any sense.
Can we talk about adverse reactions to the vaccine? Because this is the big issue that people keep raising, that the adverse reactions do not justify mass vaccination. They are too high. What do you say?
I say that is absolutely false. When we talk about adverse reactions to the vaccine, so it can be difficult to tell because billions of people around the world have been vaccinated. And if I gave billions of people around the world a glass of water and waited a few weeks, some of them would die. Some young people would die unexpectedly. So when we talk about the vaccines, what the data has actually shown is really, I think, two adverse side effects. So some of the vaccines, the Johnson & Johnson and the AstraZeneca vaccine, for example, can cause blood clots. And those can be extremely rare, but it can be severe, and there definitely have been some fatalities in the world. The mRNA vaccines, the Pfizer and the Moderna vaccines, cause myocarditis, which is inflammation of the heart. There is some discrepancy from one study to the next about how often it occurs. I think a reasonable ballpark number is that it occurs in about 1 in 10,000 people, primarily young men, after their second vaccine dose. So while there's some discrepancy about the exact rate, the prognosis of the condition, you don't want to minimize it because this is a vaccine side effect. You want to take everything seriously. But every single paper, there's now close to 30 which have reported on this clinical course, and they all report that it has a benign, favorable prognosis in the short term. Again, around the world, there have been a handful of catastrophes. There have been a handful of plausible deaths. I'm not going to deny that. But it just pales in comparison to what COVID can do, whose harms are not limited just to myocarditis. And there have been young men who have refused the vaccine because of fears of heart damage, and they have died of COVID. Death is worse than vaccine myocarditis. I feel very comfortable saying that. But it's a controversial point.
It's a controversial point. Another controversial point that remains controversial is the fact that some vaccines were mRNA. And people were highly suspicious of this. For some reason, do you understand the suspicion and what do you say?
Oh, I definitely understand the suspicion. I've been studying the anti-vaccine movement for a decade, so I know that people are skeptical of institutions, and they're not wrong to be. Pharmaceutical companies and governments have done things ranging from mildly unethical to horribly unethical over the course of our lives. So of course I understand the skepticism, and this is a new technology. I will say, however, that the vaccines were properly studied in very large randomized placebo-controlled trials, and I think governments and pharmaceutical companies have done a decent job of tracking side effects. And this, the data about these side effects doesn't just come from the United States. So let's say you're skeptical of our CDC and you're skeptical of Pfizer and Moderna, but from multiple countries around the world, from Singapore, from Europe, you know, from Australia, you guys, every country tries to keep track, not every country, but most countries try to keep track of vaccine side effects. So you can be suspicious, I think, of one or two of these places, but to say that there's this overwhelming conspiracy involving every government and every doctor around the world just doesn't hold water.
At what point do you regard unorthodox thinking, challenging thinking, as having morphed into disinformation?
So that's a good question, and I certainly don't want to be seen as someone who is opposed to heterodox thinking. A matter of fact, one of the inventors, one of the doctors, the scientist whose pioneering work led to the mRNA vaccines was kind of viewed as a crank. She's a scientist at the University of Pennsylvania, and her pioneering work led to the mRNA vaccines. I want to be very clear that the doctors who I criticize in my book got basic facts wrong, predicting COVID would kill 20,000 Americans or 40,000 Americans. And within days, those predictions were falsified, or they declared the end of the pandemic multiple times, or, as I said, treated vaccine side effects as a fate worse than death. And I do mean that literally. Doctors told young people, don't worry about dying of COVID. Your risk is very low. Worry about getting this mild transient myocarditis instead. So, you know, we need to leave room for people to have good faith disagreements when there's incomplete data and incomplete information. But when I think people get basic, basic facts wrong repeatedly in public, and they carry the weight of MD coming from Harvard, Stanford, Johns Hopkins, University of California, San Francisco, some of our most prominent universities, Oxford in the UK, that's when we begin to run into trouble.
One of the people that you discuss is a former colleague of yours, I think, Dr. Brogan. Tell me what Dr. Brogan said during the pandemic.
So Dr. Kelly Brogan is the only doctor I write about who I actually met. We trained here at New York University doing psychiatry residencies probably about 12 years ago was the last time I spoke to her. And she was really my introduction to the world of the anti-vaccine movement. As soon as she left NYU, she morphed into one of our country's most outspoken, famous anti-vaccine doctors. And she... It goes much further than most of the doctors who I write about in the book, and she is a germ theory denialist. She does not believe SARS-CoV-2 causes COVID. She does not believe HIV causes AIDS. She kind of feels the whole thing was faked. For the most part, most of the doctors I write about did not quite go that far, but I think it made them more dangerous because they mixed good information, such as we have to be very careful to protect grandma and make sure she gets vaccinated, with bad information that 20 and 30-year-olds and children should get COVID, that they should affirmatively get COVID.
Is there any evidence to suggest that the wave of disinformation is getting any smaller with time?
I don't think so. I think a lot of these people have won the pandemic, at least with regards to vaccinating young people. Our vaccination rates are very low. Parents are not vaccinating their children. At this point, of course, nearly all American children have contracted COVID. But as I said, we have 4 million babies who are born every year without natural immunity. And I think the problem is potentially getting worse in that it is bleeding into routine vaccinations for the measles, for polio, for HPV. So I'm a little pessimistic about the future. And some of these doctors have positions of high places. For example, the Surgeon General of Florida, Dr. Joseph Ladapo, recently was caught essentially faking data to make the vaccine look more dangerous than the virus. And he's been scolded online, but he hasn't suffered any professional consequences. And when we have these misinformation doctors in positions of authority and testifying before Congress and getting platformed on by major major news organizations, I just don't see it getting any better anytime soon.
Mind you, Florida's a particular case, isn't it?
Florida, that's where I grew up. So it's really a shame what's happened to my state there. They are now basically an officially anti-vaccine state, all to support the presidential ambitions of Ron DeSantis.
And what do you think that people feel about that? I mean, the people must be supportive of that.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a relatively small minority of people who support that position, but that's who he has to win over, he thinks, in order to win the Republican primary. So it's a purely political move. He is just playing to the most fervent base, the people who he feels he has to win over. I think most Americans will continue to vaccinate their children, I hope, but there are going to be pockets of unvaccinated children, and I think that's where you're going to run into trouble. So the vaccine rate overall can be very high. It could be 90% of children are vaccinated, but if the 10% who are unvaccinated all go to the same school or all live in the same neighborhood, that's where you're going to see outbreaks, and that's what's going to happen. I'd love to be wrong about that, but I don't think I am.
We can't blame all this on social media, right? What is it that makes people cleave to conspiracy theories specifically about COVID?
So I don't have all the answers to that question, but I think part of it is that people feel that a big event has to have a big cause. So the idea that this virus could just sort of come out of nowhere and totally change the world and affect the life of every human being on the planet, the idea that this has a small cause is very hard for people to believe. For example, here in the United States, there are many conspiracies regarding the assassination of John F. Kennedy Jr., as you probably know. There are no conspiracies regarding the attempted assassination of President Ronald Reagan in 1980 or 1981. Everyone accepts that it was just this lone gunman who was very mentally ill. But the reason for that, I think, is that Reagan survived and his gunshot wounds turned out to be very minor. But had that bullet been off by a centimeter and hit his heart, as it was very close to doing, we would have a ton of Ronald Reagan conspiracy theories. So I think, and there were no conspiracy theories about SARS-CoV-1 and MERS, because those outbreaks petered out. They didn't turn out to be a huge deal. So I think people want an explanation. That randomness is very hard for people to accept, and it's kind of nice to have someone to blame. Oh, this is Bill Gates' fault. This is George Soros' fault. And it makes the world seem to be more under control than perhaps it really is.
Hi, thank you for your time, Dr. Jonathan Howard, whose book is called We Want Them Infected.